Some put the primary responsibility at the media's doorstep. I don't. The media has its problems, and the most notable for me is its complicity in encouraging ideological combat to flourish because of its insatiable appetite for something or someone to pick on. But our elected leaders have the greatest power and highest responsibility to do something about it, and I think that is what most Americans want and expect them to do. Instead, most have chosen the more destructive route of practicing politics as war in order to achieve their short-term political goals. During the era of the Clinton presidency and Gingrich Republicanism, the permanent campaign, the perpetual scandal culture, and politics as war coalesced as never before. The result was all-out partisan warfare. I only have to mention some of the lowlights of that era to remind you of how it demoralized and repulsed the citizenry, halted progress on addressing our national problems, and dragged the reputation of Washington in the mud. Vince Foster, Whitewater, Travelgate, Filegate, the Gingrich government shutdown, Paula Jones, Monica Lewinsky, Wag the Dog, and the Mark Rich pardon. What a roster of national embarrassments, some substantive, some not, all fueled by two factors: the White House's lack of candor and honesty, and the partisan determination to destroy political enemies no matter what the cost. By the time of the 2000 election, the permanent campaign and its attendant ills had become status quo for the Clinton team, Congress, and Washington. The Clinton White House came to epitomize the style of governing via endless campaign, institutionalizing it as never before. It was the accepted way of doing things. Most people involved in governing and campaigns understood that political manipulation was a necessary part of how things are done, particularly in a climate of partisan war. They gave little thought to its overall effect on national politics, beyond occasional hand-wringing complaints and ineffectual sighs about the good old days. The national media became complicit enablers, as the 24-hour news networks jumped on every scandal and conflict, no matter how trivial, to fill airtime, stir the pot of controversy, and attract viewers. Political news came to resemble sports coverage, with its entertaining plays of the week, instant analysis, constant anointing of winners, losers, heroes, and goats. Many pundits did not dedicate themselves to dispassionate analysis, but cheered on one side and shouted down the other. And when partisan warfare breaks out on such a large scale, the results are terribly destructive and do lasting damage to our national political discourse. Vicious, negative attacks, distortions, spin, unsubstantiated innuendo, and misinformation become the norm. The headlines and soundbites that receive the greatest emphasis in the media too often are grounded in such unsavoriness. Caveats are de-emphasized, contradictory information is downplayed, dismissed, or simply disregarded. Complex issues are too often oversimplified in the context of winners and losers and portrayed in stark black and white terms. The side that most effectively manipulates the narrative often prevails and is lifted up as being on the offensive, at times regardless of any nuances in the larger underlying truth. Deception nudges truth to the side. I believe most of those engaging in the deceptive ways on both sides of the partisan aisle, including our elected leaders, are good people who have fallen prey to the destructive nature of the Washington game. But as manipulation is embraced more widely and becomes more accepted, a new culture starts to develop as a result of the all-out partisan warfare, a culture of deception. Sun Tzu, an ancient Chinese general, is known for his military treatise, The Art of War, written centuries before the birth of Christ. It is one of the oldest and most widely read books in existence on military strategy. It has also made a lasting imprint on business leadership and political campaigns for its strategic insights. I can't remember which political strategist first recommended the book to me years ago, but one relevant passage in the book notes that all warfare is based on deception. The Art of War goes on to discuss the many ways of employing deception when preparing for battle, ways not unlike those that might be useful for winning a campaign for elected office or exercising power when in office. Sun Tzu even points out that effective military strategy includes deceiving not just the enemy, but one's own troops as well, making them follow orders without full knowledge of their leader's true intentions. In warfare, the goal is to literally destroy the enemy. Using deception in this context is probably reasonable, since damaging relationships is a small price to pay when a life and death struggle for survival is involved. In politics, there may be a few limited, minor instances where deception is acceptable. For example, when a campaign pretends to be more active early in the process than it really is, in order to trick the other campaign into spending money and resources too early. But applying the strategy of deception broadly to politics and governance is a step too far. Unfortunately, the Sun Tzu approach has become the norm in politics, as deception is considered vital today for defeating campaign opponents and for governing. This all's fair attitude now permeates political campaigns and has crossed excessively into governing, especially when the stakes are high. Washington, as a result, has become a breeding ground for deception and a killing field for truth. Make no mistake, governing inevitably has an adversarial element. People and groups will always differ about the proper use of limited government resources. But should government be a process of constant campaigning to manipulate public opinion rather than one centered as much as possible on rational debate, deliberation, and compromise? Should it be based on all-out war and deception, or grounded in a high level of openness, forthrightness, honesty, and a search for truth? All too often, in today's politics, the spirit of warfare rules. Clinton and his team played the game extremely well. They showed an uncanny resilience and ability to persevere and prevail in the high-stakes political combat of attack and counterattack. In the end, Bill Clinton's undeniable personal flaws proved to be debilitating, but not fatal to his presidency. Why? Because Clinton had a magnetic personality, extraordinary charisma, and a rare ability to charm many Americans, as well as a deep appreciation, whether based on principle or political pragmatism, for governing toward the center. He succeeded on the policy front, enlisting Republican support and enacting policies that middle America cared about, from welfare reform to deficit reduction. He understood that a successful agenda can overcome personal shortcomings and partisan ill will. His team knew that their greatest persuader was Clinton himself, and they knew how to play the Washington game of the permanent campaign better than any previous White House. But their excessive embrace of the modern-day rules, shared by the Gingrich Republicans, came at a heavy price to the nation. Unfortunately, the incoming Bush administration learned some of the wrong lessons from watching the Clinton White House. As they planned for the new regime in Washington, they did nothing to change the status quo. Rather than thinking outside of the box of the permanent campaign, they accepted the new rules of the game and focused on how to play it better, not how to change the game to one that would better serve the American people. Ironically, much of Bush's campaign rhetoric had been aimed at distancing himself from the excesses of Clinton's permanent campaign style of governing. The implicit meaning of Bush's words was that he would bring an end to the perpetual politicking and the deep partisan divisions it created. Although Washington could not get enough of the permanent campaign, voters were seemingly eager to move beyond it. Bush emphasized this sentiment during the campaign. He would change the tone in Washington. He would be a uniter, not a divider. He would restore honor and dignity to the White House. He would govern based on what was right, not what the polls said. He would, in short, replace the cynicism of the 1990s with a new era of civility, decency, and hope. There would be no more permanent campaign, or at least its excesses would be wiped away for good. But the reality proved to be something quite different. Instead, the Bush team imitated some of the worst qualities of the Clinton White House and even took them to new depths. Bush did not emulate Clinton on the policy front. Just the opposite. The mantra of the new administration was anything but Clinton when it came to policies. The Bush administration prided itself in focusing on big ideas, not playing small ball with worthy but essentially trivial policy ideas for a White House, like introducing school uniforms or going after deadbeat dads. But a significant aspect of the Clinton presidency that George W. Bush and his advisors did embrace was the unprecedented pervasiveness of the permanent campaign and all its tactics. In hindsight, it is clear that the Bush White House was actually structured to emulate and extend this method of governing, albeit in its own way. The most obvious evidence that the Bush White House embraced the permanent campaign is the expansive political operation that was put in place from day one. Chief political strategist Karl Rove was given an enormous center of influence within the White House from the outset. This was only strengthened by Rove's force of personality and closeness to the president. He would be one of the three key players, along with Karen Hughes and Andy Card, beyond the president himself, who most defined the way the Bush White House operated. I first started getting to know Karl in 1992 when I was managing a Texas State Senate campaign that hired his political consulting firm to do direct mail. My conversations with him during that period were not extensive. He had plenty of other clients to tend to, and his work for us was primarily limited to the mailings. But Rove already was establishing himself as the guru of Republican politics in Texas. A couple of years earlier, in 1990, while the Republican gubernatorial nominee I worked for narrowly went down in defeat, two Rove clients on the statewide ballot, Kay Bailey Hutchison and Rick Perry, had won races for treasurer and agriculture commissioner, respectively, winning Rove some of his early renown as a rising political star in the state. After the state Senate campaign in Northwest Texas, which we lost ever so narrowly against an entrenched incumbent, I moved back to Austin to figure out my next move. I had some time on my hands and volunteered to help on Hutchison's nascent campaign for the U.S. Senate. It was a special election to replace Lloyd Benson, who had become Treasury Secretary. Hutchison would challenge the incumbent, Bob Krueger, previously Texas Railroad Commissioner, who had been appointed by the governor to serve until a replacement could be elected. The fledgling campaign was operating out of Rove's office space at the outset. I was helping make calls to get people to show up for Hutchison's upcoming 4-day 20-city announcement tour. Just as Hutchison was to begin the tour, her campaign manager asked if I would travel with her for the first day. At the time, Rove had already given my name to some communication strategists from a D.C. firm who were seeking talent to help one of their clients, the American Tort Reform Association, with its lawsuit reform efforts in Texas. But the thought of traveling with someone who could be the next U.S. Senator from Texas sounded like a good experience, so I quickly agreed.